So let's start with this week, which in my words is called the scratch the surface of CFT. Since you already have a whole week of CFT, I don't write down the whole thing anymore. Well, the reason of this title is that if you look at the big orange Bible of CFT, it's about this thick. And it's all about CFT in two dimensions. We're really just, in four lectures, the best we can do is scratch the first surface of it. And also, in these four lectures, we'll just be living on the surface because we're in D equals 2. I understand that, well, actually, whenever you take courses or do homework, and you should really always ask this question, wait, but why? Because, you know, there are just way too many courses and way too many, well, some of them mandatory, but if it's optional, you should say, why, right? So, but Jeremy did such a great job of spending two whole lectures motivating about CIT. So I'll just spend 2 minutes to say what's my take about why would I be interested in conformal field theory. So quite a few of you guys are together with me for the standard model lecture, but if you're not, it's okay. It's just Sean Tulin, our lecture, standard model lecture, has this really called a conservation of the prettiness of grand unified theory. So grand unified theory just saying that standard model, yeah, has problems, first of all, and they're not pretty by some standard. And then what they want to do is try to make it prettier. Oh, unified gauge theory, because standard model, I guess, it's somewhere here. Has a very nice Higgs sector. It has one Higgs. You can't really get better than that. But a gauge theory has some ridiculous SU3 cross SU2 cross SU1 whatever thing. It's crazy. And then the thing is that down the road, we find this grand unification theory basically follow on the line. It might make the gauge theory simpler, but make the Higgs sector ridiculous complicated. So that's why he said that the prettiness is conserved. But then here comes Susie. By the way, Susie is doing a great job. We at least observed 50%, well, close to 50% of the particle content. But anyway, that when Susie comes, that they propose this minimum supersymmetric model. And you look at the model, you're like, ugh. And then, but then there's the next minimum Susie model. And then you're like, no, still not good enough. There's the next minimum Susie model. And then you can just keep going, next minimum Susie model. I thought it's still minimum. Quoting my mother-in-law, Wendy, I'd rather take a needle and stick a needle in my eye than looking at their Lagrange. It's just so crazy, like, not talking about t-shirt. You can take a bed sheet and you still can keep going. So the merit of CFT is we don't have a Lagrange. We don't need one. There is no action, so you don't have ever to take a needle to stick in your eye. But as the instructor, I should say that you should never do that. But sometimes, you know, when you see a model like that, you might want to resist that urge. So the idea is, so I like this because you can get all you need, which is physics, which for us is correlation functions of operators by not having an action and do physics anyway. So that's my take. And then I guess the next thing is, no, I'm terrible at drawing, but this is the needle in the eye. And then, so then the next question is why D equals 2? Think about it. We spent 6 lectures on D equals to any dimension. So you already know how to do stuff in infinite number of dimensions. You can do it in any dimension. So which, by proportionality, really, if you pick a specific dimension equals 2, you should spend a 0 lecture on it. So you should really ask the question, why would we spend any lecture on D equals 2? And the motivation is the follows, is that first, because we can. It's like pick the squishiest fruit or the low-hanging fruit or whatever, is that this series, you can actually solve it. Well, okay, there are people like Pedro solving like N equals 4 super young males too, but this is really, you can find a infinite number of 2D, then you can just solve it. And you were like, what do you mean by solve a model? Solve a CFT. It just means that there are some miracles that we're going to introduce in the last two lectures when we get the basis done, such that the first miracle says that in a CFT, they always have a primary operator and then their descendants. So primary operator is just like partial phi, actually. But you just learned something about the primary operators. And they have descendants, and that's all there is in the theory. And the miracle is if you have such descendants of the operator, and if you wonder about the correlation function of them, it turns out they are just differential equations. You can come up with differential operators of the primaries. And then the second miracle is in 2D CFT, there are subsets of models called minimal models, says that there are only finite number of primaries. So basically, there are such models that you can just write down all the primary operators because there are finite of them. And then you can calculate all the correlation functions. They are determined by the crossing symmetry you heard about last week. And then about descendants, don't worry about it. As long as you get the primaries, the descendants will just fall. So that's what we're going to do once. Half a time. Actually, I don't know how to say half once. But we'll do half of it in lecture, and the rest will be in our homework, which is the fabled D equals 2 Ising model. And the second motivation is, well, string theory. Well, you're like, string theory is not physics. Well, we'll let Davide spend the first beautiful lecture to motivate you why, you know, string theory is something you should pursue. But the point is, we have been seeing relativity, and there's a point particle and a sweeping out a line, which is called the word line. And that particle is definitely violating something, but it's okay. No, sorry, not okay. But now we have a string. Let's take an open string. It's easier to draw. And then if it just sweep through time, you will get a sheet called the word sheet. So here we got the surface. Okay? There could be other motivations, but let's get started by saying what are we doing in these four lectures. So the first lecture, we're going to take a look at what's the conformal transformation in D equals 2. And the idea is that, say, we have two conformal transformation in D equals anything, which we're going to recap very quickly. But the idea is this is actually infinite dimensional. The generator, in other words, in the generators in D equals 2 for conformal transformation, completely geometry, no physics yet, is infinite dimensional. You have an infinite amount of generators and they all work. Which, you know, is motivate, that's why that you have so much symmetry. Think about it, with a little bit of symmetry, Wahari, they constrained our calculation that much. When you have infinite amount of them, you'll get a whole theory that is solvable. Actually, lots of whole theories that are solved. Okay, so we're gonna look at that. And of course, whenever there's transformation, they form a group, we'll take a look at their algebra. In particular, this one is called the weight algebra, which is infinitely dimensional. But it's okay, they all look very nice. They actually, this infinitely dimensional algebra looks way neater than the than the finite one that you have studied. And then, well, we have some, we introduce some concept of primary field, but you know that concept. It's just that in D equals 2, there's something called the Carroll quasi-primary field. And the most important one being the energy momentum tensor. But we'll get to that at the end of the lecture, and we'll get to some details about that in tomorrow's tutorial. We're also going to look at some very specific, well, it's infinite dimensional, but we're going to look at some specific conformal transformation, which could be interesting for string theories. Basically, look at this word sheet, but you can, since it's conformal equivalent to some strip that you already know how to do, then problem solved. And then tomorrow, we are going to do physics about the energy momentum tensor, since that's basically the only thing I could write down if I know nothing about the theory. If I think there is a field theory about some field, about a physics, there's gonna be that guy. So tomorrow we're gonna spend a whole class on that guy and doing things. So then we're gonna land, hoppefully, on the Virasoro algebra, which is the same algebra, but now with it's the physics version or quantum version. And this is also in the heart of string theory, but it's an important algebra. You probably have heard of it. And then after we have the algebra, it's like if you have an algebra, you always want to build a Hilbert space out of it. And we'll study this Hilbert space and build all our states. And then the last lecture, we're going to look at the unitarity bond. And using my words would be, we'll try to cook up my own solvable CFT. So the final goal of the four lecture is to look at D equals two Ising model and say that how is it possible actually you could just write down models that they are solvable. So we will have a general recipe and you will look at the D equals two, that's the first CFT that gets solved or any field theory gets solved in details in your homework. Okay. So that's this week. And today, of course, we come back to the first circle. We're just going to look at the conformal transformations. Before that, since it's been a week, let's do some recap. What do we have learned last week about conformal transformation? Well, what we learned is that what we call conformal transformation is that suppose there is this transformation between the x, from x go to x tilde, then the distance measured by the flat metric in the new coordinate system should be equals to using the conformal flat metric, which has this conformal factor, and measure the distance of the old coordinate. And the second thing we do is that whenever we can't proceed, in this case, in t equals two, we actually can, but suppose when we cannot proceed, we always do is, suppose we're only doing an infinitesimal transformation with this vector, killing vector, then we get this killing vector equation. So that's just what it is. You say it's the Casimir is infinitesimal, you do linear expansion, then you get this equation. And then the last thing, let's write it here. So last thing says, okay, let's solve this guy, which I'm sure you have lots of notes on how to obtain this, which is not the prettiest thing ever, but you can organize in the following way. So suppose I have CFT in D dimension bigger than 2. Well, I'm terrible at drawing boxes. Okay. Then you, of course, have all your Lorentz sitting here. And then you have some dilatation, where I just decided to write there. And then what we have left is some translation and some special transformation, which is denoted the p nu and the k nu. And the idea is you can do linear combination. It's really plus and minus of them. But I decided to just call them tutors that you can organize in the following way, such that this whole thing, which captured all the generators, is still a sort of a Lorentz generators. Except now, before we have 0 da, 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 to d minus 1, and now there's something called minus 1, minus 2. Don't mind the numbers. It just says it's more than this. So instead of having Lorentz in d-dimensional and have these translation, special conformal transformation, dilatation, you can also do some linear combination and claim the group representing the CFT in d-dimension is really SO d plus 1 dot 1, right? You should have seen this too. Okay, and fun fact, this happens to be the isometry of EDS d plus 1. So here you go. This is the teeny bit taste of the amuse of the EDS CFT. At least they share the same symmetry group. So I could post a tutorial that's ask you to study this, and then you will realize this is also this. Okay. So now let's finally actually start the lecture today, which is conformal transformation in D equals 2. Okay, so our Kaelin equation in D equals 2, I'm just copying the equation and doing one simple thing is taking D equals 2. And another thing is we decide to leave in Euclidean metric. And I just imagine weak rotation will solve every problem that will cost us. But from our purpose, we'll leave it on the Euclidean worksheet and take the metric to be delta mu nu, which is defined the Euro way. The good thing about D equals 2 is normally I discourage you to write things explicitly and want to make the full use of this upper and lower index and never expand anything. Well, in D equals 2, it's different since you're only running from 0 to 1. It's not such a terrible idea, just take 0 and 1 and expand everything out. So that's the first one. That's 1. And then there's another guy. Right? Those are the only two independent partial differential equations. And this cancels. What it gives you is partial 0 cos 0 equals partial 1 cos 1, and the partial 0 cos 1 equals minus percent cos 0. Everybody agree with that? there's, it's good, but it's funny somehow. Okay, sure. I encourage you to laugh, even if I have no idea what's going on. And so can anybody tell me?
Cauchy-Riemann equation.
It's Cauchy-Riemann equation, exactly. So let's see. So I will see what the Cauchy-Riemann equation says. There is a function of the first component of function is u, which is a function of xy. Second component is a function of xy. And then what we learned is that if we have partial u, partial x equals to partial v, partial y, and the partial v, partial x equals minus partial u, partial y, and the conclusion is f must be a holomorphic function on the complex plane. So here we go. Problem solved. Well, this is very exciting because the lesson is by looking at the conformal Killing equation, we say we should have lived on the complex plane, which you lived there with Tibera for some time, which you spend a lot of effort. So now it's the time to harvest the crops on the plane and maybe brew them into beer. And the flavor is probably complex. But let's harvest our fruit and the crops, is try to make use of that later on. But this is our solution. It says any holomorphic function of Z would just work. But let's take a sanity check, say, does it actually work? You're like, okay, we should take the line element on the plane and then change it to a complex coordinate system. It should be proportional to dz, dz bar. It might be exactly equal. And then let's see what dz, if we do this holomorphic transformation plus the anti-holomorphic transformation, what happens is now we have dfz, df bar, z bar. And this would equals the partial fz, partial z, partial f bar z bar, partial z bar, dz, dz bar. And now we're happy, says this is the conformal factor we're looking for. Indeed, any holomorphic function transformation is indeed a conformal transformation with a conformal factor that we can identify. And you say it is crucial that these guys only depends on Z. These guys only depends on Z bar. Otherwise, you could have a bunch of other things you don't want. Because the line element literally only have this term. It doesn't have the Z term, it doesn't have the Z bar, Z bar. Okay, so that's the conformal transformation we seek after, and I don't know what to do. So let's take our Euro approach, leave close to identity, and do a Laurent expansion. So whenever we don't know what to do, in general, we can always say, let's take an infinitesimal approach and see if that's going to help us. So now I would say my transformation is z equals z, some infinitesimal transformation, and I will expand it from minus infinity to infinity, and it has this curious exponent. It's a convention to make bookkeeping easier. But whenever I have an infinitesimal transformation, I can always do. So this is the original thing, and the rest is the small thing. And then we take all this a n to be small. This is just a sensible thing to do. And then we can identify our vector field with a curious, another conventional minus sign. but we can identify our vector field to be this. And I have used this notation such that things get easier to be written. So if it's just a partial derivative in 2D CFT, that equals derivative over z. And if it's derivative over z bar, then it's a bar on top. It's a very, it agrees with a lot of other people. So that's our vector field. So how do we find the algebra? Well, we have the generators, we do commutator from to get the algebra, right? So it's really first couple week of calculus will bring you this calculation. Well, you might not realize this is what you're doing, but you were actually calculating the weight algebra. That's that. And then the commutator says that I should switch the letter M and N and copy the rest of things. And then, so this partial still act on something. The only thing I need to do is compute this derivative, and the other term will be canceled from the other term. So the only thing I need to do is bring m plus 1 down. And I would have this. And the other one, I don't have to think, but swap the m and n's. So this gives us m minus n, z to the m plus 1 partial. And if I take the conventional minus n out, I get n minus m. And plus it. What happens to the numerical factor here? Right? So that's it. And you really don't have to repeat the calculation and just realize if you add a bar to everything, this should also work. And it's also very easy to convince yourself that these two infinite dimensional algebra do not talk to each other. So you have one set of infinite dimensional algebra, and then you have another copy from the anti-holomorphic operators, and then you realize they don't talk to each other. So you have the direct product of two infinite dimensional algebra. And this is what's called weight algebra. And it has a curious other name, which is known as the local conformal algebra. Huh. At this point, is there any question? Okay, calculus plus simple algebra manipulation from middle school brings us here, which is nice. Okay, but now you should really have a question. Why is it called a local conformal algebra? Is there a global conformal algebra? Yes, there is. So let's hunt this global conformal algebra. Well, so basically the question is, I just write down this vector field, and then you should have some doubts in mind. So at this point, n literally takes any integers between minus infinity and infinity. And you should really ask yourself, well, maybe that's a little too bold. And maybe at some point on the complex plane, this is not possible. And where are these specific region of complex plane that we don't always want to do this. Think about n can be negative. On the complex plane, zero, right? Zero. So exactly, at z equals zero, this, we want this at least not to be negative. So we have n equals, that bigger equals to minus one. That's very nice. So if zero is problematic, infinity is probably also problematic. But on the other hand, we have a conformal algebra which has a very, very good district symmetry called inverse. Exactly. So I have no idea if this thing, how this thing is defined at infinity, but I can always look at 1 over z, which we reduced to the problem, the previous problem for mathematician. They were like, okay, problem solved. Then we can try to have look what happens to this guy. So what happens to this guy is, let's say partial z, now I'll restore this index because now there's two variables. It'd be silly not to. So that's what it is, and this gave you 1 over z squared partial w, which is minus w squared partial w. And now let's look at ln is equals minus 1 over w to the n plus 1 minus w partial w, which is w minus n minus 1 plus 2, which is minus n plus 1. Now we know that the w is getting close to 0. By the same argument, we want the exponent to be non-negative. And this gives us n is smaller or equal to 1. So in order for this algebra to be globally defined, which means literally just 0 and infinity is defined because everywhere else it's perfectly fine, that we have restriction on our n. They can't just be any integers. It should be integer between minus 1 and 1. So there are three integers, which means I can list them. So there's L1, L0, L minus 1. And don't forget these anti-holomorphic guys, since we don't do any calculation about them, but they are hanging out there. And all the arguments follows. So that tells us that there are 6 generators. Yeah.
Maybe I'm too late for this question, but why does it make sense to use these vector fields?
Why?
The vector fields like this.
It's
yeah, why?
It's really, this is the infinite transformation, and this is the vector field we generate.
Okay.
It's like you have translation, then you write your momentum to be partial. So for example, if you take n equals minus 1, so which is the translation. We're going to get there, but the n equals minus 1 is a translation because there's no z dependent. And then you get the partial, which is the momentum. Actually, good. We're going to come back to look at specifically what these generators generate, what kind of transformation they generate. So that will come up in 1.5 minutes also. So there are 6 generators, but why 6 is so curious? Why I'm so happy about the number 6? Fun fact. Well, you might not have found it so funny, but I have it very different. So 6 happened to equals to 4 times 3 over 2. And how is that helping me? Well, I would see that n times n minus 1 over 2 is basically a recipe of calculating the number of generators of the special orthogonal group. So this happens to have the same number of generators as this guy. When you count generators, you don't care about how many negative signature you have. So, and fun fact, along not that long, but some fun fact. No, I didn't erase anything. Okay, it's right above, actually. Ah, this is not good because it's blocked by the reflection of light. But it tells us if we just use that formula to calculate how many, what's the conformal field theory, the group, it's indeed SO31. So it agrees with what we have learned last week, which is good. So the global conformal algebra is actually exactly the same algebra we have calculated before. So there must be translation, dilatation, Lorentz, and the special conformal transformation hiding in this six things. And let's answer Carlos' question, is where it is hiding. We can actually look at this transformation, and I'm just losing force, to look at what kind of transformations these six generators will lead us. Oh. Not very good with this board. By looking at them basically one by one. Well, by that, I meant I'll look at half of them, and hopefully the other half will work. Normally it does. Okay, so let's look at L minus one. The generator Lm minus one, if we look at the infinitesimal transformation, which is right there, that corresponds to a infinitesimal transformation of a minus one z to the minus one plus one, which is a minus one. That is a constant. So it corresponds to, so the full transformation is z goes to z plus a minus one. And this is a, what kind of transformation is if I take z and say add a constant to it? Translation. I'm not gonna continue unless you tell me. All right, so done. L zero, so this corresponds to the transformation that a zero z to the zero plus one, which is a zero times z. So this corresponds to, you take a z and put a zero next to it, so you can write it this. And which transformation does this correspond? Dilatation with a catch. This is very good. This is dilatation. You take a z and rescale, because now we're living in a complex numbers. So it's really dilatation. So think about this. I should have write as r e to the I phi using the polar coordinate of the complex number. So actually, what is the more, it's actually the combination of this guy and the anti-guy is the dilatation. And the difference actually corresponds to the rotation. Because, so this guy, if you work it out, is r partial r, and this guy you work out is partial phi. So a translation in the phi direction is really a rotation. So these two guys give us dilatation, and one dilatation, there's only one, but the one rotation, because we're leaving on the plane. The only thing we can do is rotate on this particular plane. And then we have the next guy, which is L1. Before doing any calculation, can anybody tell me what should I expect? What transformation I should expect by looking at the L equals to L1. Yeah, that's the only thing left. So well, let's see it. So this guy corresponds to, for this one, we have to take some leap of faith, but, and you're like, this doesn't look like the special conformal transformation that we learned. Well, let's just keep writing and see what happens. So there, I get something like this. Okay, now it's the time to take a leap of faith. Says that I can write this as the linear expansion of the following guy. This you do it all the time. 1 plus x is 1 over 1 minus x. You don't even, okay, there is some big O of the cube. Who cares? So let's propose this is the special conformal transformation I'm seeking after. But why? You're like, the thing we saw from last week is something basically John might just refuse to calculate on board. It's like, it's complicated. You can see, look at the notes. It's very complicated to get those three terms to show that's the special conformal transformation. But on the other hand, remember the fun trick we used already. What is a special conformal transformation? Excellent. We're indeed going to use this guy, which means we use the same trick we already used. Says D is 1 over W, and this we can call it D tilde, and the D tilde, of course, is 1 over W tilde. And let's see what happens. On the left, it's just 1 over W tilde. On the right is 1 over W, 1 minus A1 over W. And you can make it better. Just simplify it. Again, middle school algebra. We'll bring you to this, which tells us W tilde is W minus A1, which tells you exactly this is special conformal transformation because we did the inverse, translation, inverse. Yay! Everything worked out. So this is the conformal transformation. And indeed, if you count it, there's this guy. So there are two translations because the anti-holomorphic guy, there's two. Special conform, let me just write it. There's two translation, and there's two special conformal transformation. There's one dilatation, and then there's one rotation, which is the Lorentz. Okay, we have six of them, and they worked out. So now, let's get a little bit organized. Which you would do, it's not hard at all, to get a little bit organized and say that we can actually combine this all together enlightened by this guy. So what we will do is we actually say FZ equals to AZ plus B, CZ plus D, and this is what we call the global conformal transformation. And at this point, you should be, well, if you say, I mean, there's some, what we have so far is like a translation, you just cross the denominator out, and there's some rotation, which you cross denominator out, and the only thing needed the denominator is the special conformal transformation. Except there is a catch. There were six transformations before. Now there are four. Complex parameters. That's not good. We're not even matching the parameters. So what's going on?
There's another condition.
Right, there should be another condition. And the reason is I could totally scale A, B, C, D by lambda, or by a factor of two, whatever. This would be the same transformation. So that is called a redundancy. So we should get rid of this. But look, there's the ABCD. Habitually, if you did a lot of linear algebra in your life, you'll be saying, let's write a matrix. To say, whenever I see this matrix, it is the one-to-one correspondence to this transformation, except it's not because of this. You can scale everybody. It's a different matrix, but it's the same transformation. So indeed, we put a condition on it. This condition you must be very familiar with, which is called take the determinant goes to one. It's like when you learn orthogonal group, you say take the determinant to one, you get a special orthogonal group. You take the, then you get a special, all this special really just means the matrix determinant goes to one. So now let's give a name to this guy, which is special because that. And it's a linear algebra because of that. It's in two dimensional, and then there's a catch, is now we're living on the complex plane. So this is the group of this matrix. And you can, of course, show that it forms a group. It definitely does. And there is another catch. You can also do the following thing, which is you take M, and then you add a minus sign to everybody, which will give you the same determinant, which is fixed to be one, but it's still the same transformation. So this fixed determinant to one thing get rid of two parameters. So after you have this condition, which is AD minus BC equals one, which is a complex number equation, we're down to three complex parameters, which is six. That's good. But there is still this subtle thing says there's also a Z2 you should modulo out to get what the transformation is. And there is a mathematic fun fact, which we should find some mathematician to ask about it. But this happens to be in group sets to equals to the SO31 group that we just found, which is there, which agrees with, you know, when we look at the number six and get super excited about it. So these things agree. So this is a global conformal transformation on 2D, and you will have a taste of this, more of it, in the tutorial tomorrow. And is there any questions here? So now we know what is the conformal transformation, and then we learned about the algebra. We realized we can try to find the very teeny zero set of, because it's a finite dimensional global algebra, which match with what we learned before. We match with these things, translation, dilatation, and et cetera. And of course, 2D is special because the weight, infinite dimensional weight algebra has other things that is not captured by this. And that's why we're gonna spend a whole week on it. Well, 4 days on it. Okay. Is there any question? No? Carry on? Well, you can think about question. Well, I erase board. No idea which board I want to erase. So there's no question. Everything is clear. Okay, I'm not sure it's good enough that. That's what it is. So the next thing, in the last little bit of time, we're just going to recap what we learned. That about the primary fields, because we're in two dimension again, there's something special about it, and then we'll just talk about it. I'll hold it. I assume this is how it works. Okay. So the last little bit of time, we're going to talk about the primary field, which we will see the power of symmetry. Symmetry is very powerful. I think we have done enough homework to show that. Okay. So let's explain them one way. Every word. Primary, I think it means VIP, but it's very important things. But in the mathematical sense, we have learned that if there's field we called primary, it means that if I have a primary field phi, which come with a scaling dimension h and h bar, because now there's the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part. And if I do a simple scaling, and the new field at the new location should be given by lambda to the minus h, lambda bar to the minus h bar, phi of z, z bar. So I think this is what you learned as a definition of, well, I applied it only to the specific case of scaling transformation, but this, the primary field certainly satisfies this. And okay, you are like, what's h and h bar? It's like before, so h is like the eigenvalue of the translation, the dilatation operator, but with the catch of h plus h bar is actually your dilatation operator, which will give you the scaling dimension in h minus h bar, since it's corresponding to the rotation that actually give you spin. But we'll focus on spin zero. So, like if I want to write it with everything, which means instead of scaling transformation, I'll just take any holomorphic transformation, any anti-holomorphic transformation. By the look of this, this is going to give me minus h, and the other guy gives me minus h bar. And the phi z z bar. So this is indeed called the primary field. If we do any conformal transformation, for us it's just a holomorphic function, then the field will transform in this way. So this is for if it's any f, then this is what we call a primary field. But since we're in 2D, it's very special. Sometimes it's only when Fz take the global form of this guy, then this is called the quasi-primary field. So it's primary field on only 6 generators. And then, so that's the primary field and the quasi-primary field explained. And one thing we like to introduce so that we only do calculation on the holomorphic and hope the anti-holomorphic just work out. So the chiral field is just defined to be you have a field, but it happens to be only dependent on Z, then we call this chiral. And if it's anti-chiral, it just means that we have something and it's only depending on Z bar. And of course, I should state what is a field. In CFT knowledge, field is and the local operators are the same. So in QFT, you have phi, and then it's a scalar, you have psi, spinner, you have A, which is a vector field. But here, it's defined to be local operators. So for example, the scalar field, if it's a field, we call it a field too. But partial phi is also called a field. Actually, partial phi in D equals 2 is the primary field that we seek after. It's very important. And then you can also write some funny thing like e to the I alpha phi. So this thing, since it only depends on locally on ZZ bar, this is also a field. So fields are literally local operators. So these are all different fields, except this guy is the primary field and the other guys are descendant. Okay, so the last thing I want to say is that the T mu nu with mu and nu run from 0 and 1 is the energy momentum tensor you can show, which in the tutorial tomorrow, is that it is a chiral, it contains a chiral quasi primary field and a anti chiral quasi primary field. So in D equals 2, we again has energy momentum tensor is traceless. And further, because of this, you can just write on the component in XY coordinate, and then you change it into the complex plane. Then you find that this condition give us lovely, well, also the conservation law, give us lovely consequences, such as this component just vanish. And if you look at the component in the ZZ component, it's a field or operator only depends on Z. And then if you look at the Z bar component, it's a operator only depends on Z bar. It's a miracle. Before you have this two indexes, the tensor has three components because it's symmetric, three components, but each component could totally be a function of both Z and Z bar. And turn out those two things are the only things we need to study. And we can actually just focus on the chiral quasi-primary field T of Z and forget about the other guy because everything looks the same. So the only thing we need to study is this guy. And we'll spend a whole lecture studying the expansion of that, recalculate the algebra, and hopefully land on Virasoro algebra when it's 10 tomorrow.